You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, May 2nd, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, J. David McSwain, reporter at ProPublica, author of Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and the Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. Also on the program today, Nancy Pelosi visits Ukraine as the U.S. becomes more committed to waging a proxy war. EU weighs phasing out fuel. Meanwhile, evacuation of civilians from the Mariupol steel factory underway. Dismal pair of polls out for the Democrats in 2022. Connecticut passes a place of refuge law to protect American women from other states' anti-abortion laws. White House mulls student debt forgiveness and, of course, are having an internal battle over whether to means test it. New York Times reporters save their reporting on McConnell's fears of a child tax credit to make money off their book. DOJ files a federal court complaint calling the Alabama anti-transgender-affirming care ban unconstitutional. Omicron continues to mutate in this country. New England, northeastern numbers, climbing exponentially. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Monday. Joining me, as always, till of course she gets COVID, which apparently in this city, something like 1.6 million people got COVID. Like what was it in the past? Like 3 months? 1.8
during Omicron. So that was one quarter of the population in the city
in the first quarter of this year.
Emma
Vigeland.
Hi. I'm just scrambling to verify that. A quarter of New York City adults, 1.8 million people, got COVID-19 during the latter half of the winter Omicron surge, according to a study from CUNY School of Public Health. That is a staggering figure.
That is a staggering figure.
Hello. I hope I don't get COVID, but thank you.
I hope you don't either.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, you got to back off your camera, because I now, to match up with yours, I look like I'm like a Lilliputian. With all due respect to me.
I mean, I have to do this?
Yeah.
If you just
stay there. Stay where you are, Emma.
Okay.
All right. Let's get into this. We got a lot to get to today. We also may send Emma out of the building into the Gowanus Canal gondola that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Replete with Venetian coxswain,
right,
and to check out
those don't come cheap.
A rally? No, they don't.
That's what Peacock bought us.
Exactly.
It is,
and
Peacock
to have invested all that money in for this one opportunity. It may have not been worthwhile, but there is supposedly the Amazon voting is continuing or starting today. We may have a result rather quickly. This is for the second factory in Staten Island, or warehouse, I should say, Amazon warehouse, LDJ 5. the tally's happening today. There's going to be a rally at 1 p.m. In downtown Brooklyn. So Emma may run out to cover that and see, at the very least, maybe send us some live pictures. Then, get back onto the boat. And
I might be a little sweaty when I return.
Yeah. We'll see.
Although that's, par for the course.
So stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, here is Joe Manchin. And, look, Joe Manchin's numbers have gone up in West Virginia. His approval.
17 points.
17 points.
Morning Consult said that 57% of voters approve of Manchin compared to 40% in the first quarter of 2021, meaning he's increased significantly, particularly among Republicans after nuking the Biden agenda.
Now, this does not mean that he's going to win his reelection bid in 2024 because these Republicans may like a Republican better. But it does give you a sense of, how Joe Manchin's operating. This clip really shouldn't be safe for work because I think you might get sick from it. But here's Joe Manchin endorsing one of the Republicans in a Republican runoff as a way of distancing himself from the Democratic agenda.
I've always said, if I can't go home and explain it, I can't vote for it. And that's why I oppose Build Back Better. For Alex Mooney and his out-of-state supporters to suggest David McKinley supported Build Back Better is an outright lie. David McKinley has always opposed reckless spending because it doesn't make sense for West Virginia. Alex Mooney has proven he's all about Alex Mooney. But West Virginians know David McKinley is all about us.
I'm David McKinley, and I approve this message.
I mean, this is pretty shocking stuff. He's talking about a Republican. They're bragging about how they crushed Build Back Better. And that is relevant. It was a piece in Business Insider, which is really just basically reporting upon some elements of this new book by those two New York Times reporters, Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns. Their book is This Will Not Pass. It is going to be released tomorrow. Business Insider got a hold of it, and there was some very key revelations in there. One was that Mitch McConnell confided to a friend last year. Understand, it's possible these guys, these two New York Times reporters found this out only 4 or 5 months ago. I mean, to get it into a book, you need a certain amount of lead time.
Mm.
Maybe it was 3 months ago, but I doubt it.
But it might have been helpful to talk about how
Mitch McConnell,
this story, yeah.
McConnell was unnerved by the expanded child tax credit. This is according to that book. Shortly after the law's passage in 2021, McConnell privately confided to a friend that it was among the numerous social benefits that could prove too popular for Republicans to dislodge, even if they regained control of Congress. Quote, if Americans grew used to the benefits of the new law, he suggested, it would become politically untenable for Republicans to repeal its most popular measures. This is what Burns and Martin wrote. The country, McConnell lamented, might cross a point of no return, be becoming a European-style social welfare state, exactly the outcome he had spent his career arguing up against. Now, look, here's the point about holding that back. McConnell ended up being wrong. The child tax credit was not broadly popular. It was popular amongst the people who got it. It kept it eliminated child poverty by one-third. In this country, we see it creeping back up as soon as the child tax credit expired. But the point being that had we known this contemporaneously to the time that it, or approximately contemporaneously, this would have become a political narrative that the Republicans are terrified of this. And maybe it would have been easier to push the Democrats to move quicker. Imagine all these Republicans show up at the White House to negotiate Build Back Better in May of last year, and there's a narrative out there that they're terrified of the child tax credit. Well, why are you talking to Republicans who are afraid of the political implications of the stuff in this bill? They're not going to sign on to it. Ultimately, as you know, Joe Manchin was the key figure who blocked the renewal of the child tax credit, as he refused to vote for Build Back Better months and months and months and months after this went down with McConnell, months after he had the opportunity to make sure that he had the financial backing and the support of no labels and Republicans, and just a long time to marshal all the forces to support him in refusing to sign on to this. Because, look, if the people of West Virginia knew that Joe Manchin was instrumental in giving Joe Biden an opportunity to have the most amount of federal judges confirmed to the federal bench in this amount of time for the presidency, if that had been hammered over and over and over and over again by Joe Manchin, West Virginia voters may have reacted to that, but they didn't. He wanted this as the mechanism in which to raise his approval numbers. But there could have been other mechanisms. But this was just the low-hanging fruit. And the reason why it was low-hanging fruit is because there was no cost associated with it, because he had time to build an entire campaign around it, and that time was offered to him by the White House, essentially.
And compare that with the all-out blitz to get the Biden COVID relief package out in time for the Georgia runoffs, essentially. I mean, that created an urgency because the electoral consequences were so immediate, as opposed to like this protracted, long, let's split up infrastructure into two packages.
Right.
Let's make sure that we're negotiating for months on end. The political ramifications are just as dire if that package was not passed, and yet it was not met with the same urgency.
Yep.
Because it's, you know, it killed them. It killed them. And Biden did not make any effort to put the child tax credit front and center and attach Manchin to it going away.
Here is what the book says about Manchin and his perspective on the child tax credit. The authors wrote that the conservative Democrat had privately complained to some of his colleagues that the enhanced child tax credit would pay people to have more kids when West Virginia families couldn't afford the ones they already had. Manchin also told Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, like, I mean, how important would this stuff have been to have come out when all of this stuff was relevant? Manchin also told Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey that he believed the money would be spent on drugs. That caused Booker to rebut and tell him that families would use it on everyday expenses like diapers. This is according to Martin and Burns, authors Martin and Burns, as opposed to the reporters for the New York Times, Martin and Burns. One wonders how they divvied this stuff up. This is going to be great for the book. This will put some cash in our pockets. This will be good to let people know about. Eh. All right. We will get to David McSwain in just a moment. First, a couple words from our sponsors. I have been getting better and better about taking care of myself. Just general wellness. One big part of that. My doctor was like, why don't you go on regular vitamins? Okay. How do I maintain this? Because every time I've ever started any type of habit of taking vitamins, I get through the first bottle and then I'm done because I forget to get them the bottle after that, and then I stop. Well, Ritual has changed that for me. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients that are in bioavailable forms that your body can actually use. Not only will you not find sugars, GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, and all artificial colorants, you will find that they have fresh taste. They have delayed-release capsule designed to make taking your vitamins easy. Ritual delivers high-quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just two daily pills. Incidentally, when I went for my annual, my doctor has been telling me that now I have a good level of vitamin D. It's always been a big problem for me. It's available for women, men, and teens. Ritual multivitamins are scientifically developed to help support at different life stages. But here's the thing for me that is sort of the killer app of this. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping. You could start, snooze, or cancel your subscription at any time. Super easy. If you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. That's the thing that's been great about it for me, is that my vitamin D is up, which is important, I guess, for, you know, like prostate cancer, I guess. I don't know. But it has to do with the sun.
And your mood, too, right?
That hasn't worked.
There's no amount of vitamin D.
But the bottom line is I'm getting it, and I'm taking it consistently for the first time in my life, and it is due to Ritual. You can get key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/majority to start your Ritual today. That's ritual.com/majority. Also, I recently started using Aura. What is Aura? Well, you may not know this, but the fastest growing crime in America today is identity theft. It happens to 1 in 20 Americans. And despite this, people who have their identity stolen are often shocked when it happens. We don't hear much about it. Just imagine for a moment you try and log into your email account one day. The password has been changed. Just hours ago, you start getting notifications of activity from your bank, your credit cards, your crypto accounts, whatever it is. That's when you start having feelings of panic, fear, anxiety, paranoia. You're shocked that it happened. You're angry, your frustration, and then you feel bad because you didn't do anything about it in the first place. That's why I'm excited to partner with Aura. They are sponsoring this program today. You can get a free trial at aura.com/majority. Aura is identity theft protection. It is fraud monitoring, provides a VPN. It is password management and antivirus software all combined into one easy-to-use app. Then you could choose which of those products you want to deploy. You could deploy all of them. You can deploy some of them. Aura monitors the dark web for your emails, your passwords, your social security numbers, and sends alerts fast right to your phone and email. In fact, as soon as I signed up, and I have multiple email things, so I switched them out a couple times to see which ones, but it told me immediately where this email had been, where it had been compromised, what outfit, what password associated with it. Also, I'm using their password, their one-stop password thing, so I no longer needed a written-out encrypted thing.
Oh, nice.
Yes, that is a huge thing. Their VPN allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. You can connect your credit card and bank accounts and get notified of any changes up to 4 times faster than Aura's competitors. And when it comes to fraud, every second matters. Their antivirus software will block malware and viruses before they infect your devices. You can protect you and your family from America's fastest growing crime. Try Aura free for 2 weeks and see if you or your family's personal information has been compromised. You'll see that immediately. You can start your free trial at aura.com/majority. And of course, we'll put the links in our YouTube and podcast descriptions. And just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at the Majority Report and get the free half, free of commercials, and the fun half as well. All right. I want to welcome to the program J. David McSwain. He's a reporter at ProPublica. He is author of his just introduced Pandemic, Inc., chasing the capitalists and thieves who got rich while we got sick. David, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with sort of almost like the, I guess, the predicate here, which is we were completely unprepared for a pandemic, particularly in terms of like things like PPE. Will you just walk us through that?
Yeah. So when COVID hit, we had something like 1% of what we needed in the strategic national stockpile, these warehouses throughout the country that are designed to sort of rapidly respond to a bioterrorism threat or a contagion. And that's the result of about 10 years of political fighting here in Washington, starting with those Tea Party wave days back in 2010. And just, you know, our political leaders ignoring the warning signs that had really been spelled out very clearly in many government reports and lessons learned from, for instance, swine flu H1N1 in 2009. So we've just, you know, we were flat-footed, and you add to that the Trump administration, which really wanted to downplay the virus and sort of avoid the pandemic altogether. So we were in a big mess.
Was that part of the sequestration? I mean, there was a in 2010 when essentially, I guess Obama and the Democrats, I don't know, they thought they would box in the Republicans by saying, we're going to cut everything across the board, including the military. And the Republicans were like, okay. And so we ended up taking these deep, deep cuts into discretionary spending. Was that in part a function of that?
Yeah, it was actually a direct result of sequestration and sort of began this ratcheting down effect that we saw over 10 years. So the Republicans leveraged the debt ceiling, and you know, that was part of an effort to really undermine the Affordable Care Act and everything the Obama administration wanted to do. And as a result of that, the Democrats were forced to make cuts really across government, and especially within the Health and Human Services. And deep down in their budget is the CDC and these other agencies, including the Strategic National Stockpile. So Democrats sort of found themselves painted into a corner, started making cuts, and the stockpile suffered as a result of that, despite, you know, many warnings that we really needed to beef up our supplies.
What does 1% of a strategic reserve look like? I mean, it's almost like it's oxymoronic, right? I mean, it's not a strategic reserve,
right,
if there's 1% of what you've decided you need. Like, I don't even understand, like,
right,
which is, when you have 1% of stuff that you need for something like this, is this like you're just renting out the corner of somebody else's warehouse, or are there actually warehouses there that have 90% nothing in them?
Yeah. In the book, I think I refer to it as a not so strategic stockpile. Its idea was good, but its execution was really lousy. And there were a few reasons for that. One was something like half of the budget for the stockpile was really swallowed up by this relationship with a few corporations that provide like the anthrax treatments, for instance, which is extremely unlikely that we'd even need them. We, in fact, haven't since 2001. So, you know, you've got limited resources. And then on top of that, a lot of the stuff in the stockpile, including these masks, had passed their expiration date. They were falling apart.
Right.
So we didn't have anything. We didn't have enough of what we needed. And we found ourselves in this position where we needed to get things out of China, which was locking down and not exporting things. And the national response really became to just throw money at anyone and everyone with an LLC and an email address. So the national well-being was really in the hands of these mercenaries that I detail in the book. And they took the federal government and states and hospitals for a ride, and the American people got screwed.
Let's talk about some of those individual cases, and then I want to sort of broaden out into like what the system was supposed to be, as opposed to like I know a guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not even like it's almost not even I know a guy. It's like I know a guy who might be Like it's one of those type of things. But this your sort of journey on this. How did you end up on this private jet with Robert Stewart? And tell us about Robert Stewart.
Right. So this was, these are those really scary weeks. We're all locked down. And I'm realizing as a reporter, I'm fairly new to DC and at ProPublica. This is the biggest story of our lifetimes, hopefully. And every reporter in the world is on the same story. So I'm trying to figure out what to do. And I decided just to focus on the spending and the money coming out of DC. The CARES Act had passed, and we're going to see hundreds of millions and eventually billions flying out to contractors as the Trump administration wanted to catch up. And we just sort of broke it down, and I took a look at the Veterans Administration, which oversees the largest hospital network in the country. Their biggest contractor at the time was a guy named Robert Stewart Jr., who got a $34.5 million deal for something like $6,000,095. And at the time, no one was able to get these respirators. So I decided just to call him and ask him how the hell he did it. And he says, I'm the real deal. I'm hopping on a private jet in the morning to oversee the delivery of these masks. And I said, man, that's amazing. Can I tag along? And hours later, I'm on a private jet to Chicago by way of Georgia, for some reason, where we pick up his parents, and just over 36 hours or so, slowly started to realize that these masks were not materializing. I'm being introduced to this really weird underworld of crazy characters, and it set me off on about a year and a half of reporting just some really absurd behavior and graft as a result of our lack of preparation.
So tell us about Robert Stewart. I think there's some obvious questions, like, why is he picking up his parents? Why would he want a reporter to watch him fail at this? I mean, because when he got on that plane, he thought that he was going to get those masks in Chicago, right? And I imagine it was like, my parents have never been on a plane before, or a private jet or something, right? I mean, what was going on there?
I'll never truly understand his motivations. Getting to know him and spending some time with him, I realized that I think there was, and this becomes sort of a central tension in the book. He seemed to be lamenting this underworld of what he called buccaneers and pirates, people who are taking advantage of us in our time of need. And at the same time, trying to figure out whether or not he was, in fact, one of these buccaneers and pirates. Was he, this entrepreneur that we hold up in society as sort of an American hero, or was he taking advantage? And I think he may have thought bringing me along would prove that he was legitimate, and he may have believed he could procure the masks. But I come to find out later he was actively defrauding the federal government in other ways, and he'd eventually be charged with, three crimes as a result of that behavior.
I have had some experience with people who are frauds in that manner. I don't want to say anything that's going to get me sued, but and I think it's a combination of malevolence in some instances, but also just sort of like they're a little bit unbalanced emotionally in some respects too. I think like they're not quite clear what they're doing. It feels like, but what was his expertise? Like, how did he get this contract? What was he doing prior to that? And tell us the name of his LLC too, because that's pretty fun.
Yeah, yeah. So the company was Federal Government Experts, which sort of stood out to me.
A little on the nose.
That explains it. Yeah.
A little on the nose. That's part of why I was curious about it. The website had a bunch of plagiarized material, and it just sort of jumped out at me. And as you said, I've in the course of reporting at various levels have come across people who, are trying to get their hand in the government cookie jar. And, you find that sometimes people want to talk to you, people who are engaged in this behavior, because it's almost like they want to be caught. And I came to believe that maybe I was his confessor in a way. And, I'll never fully understand why he did it. But I began wondering, you know, is this malevolence, or, you know, is he just over his skis? And it really wasn't clear for more than a year when, you know, I was able to get some records through FOIA that proved that, you know, he was very deliberately misleading the federal government.
How did he get, was he just that good at misleading people, or was the system messed up? I mean, one of the things your book reminds me of is a book by a guest that we've had on many times on this program called The Guns and the Dudes and the Guns, I think it was, by Guy Lawson.
Yeah.
And that whole story was just like these guys just got onto the website and started to bid, and then we're like, oh, okay, we got it, and then had to buy, you know, crappy guns, and I can't remember, it was like Albania or something, and I mean, it has that feel to it, but there is obviously a lot more sort of like panic going on. But was this guy good at the process in which to bid for things, or was there somebody who was sort of craning him in, and there was somebody who was like greasing the wheels for their people?
This was even dumber than all of that, to be honest with you. So Robert Stewart did have a background in federal government contracting. He'd worked as a contract officer at the Pentagon, so he understood the system. But I came to find out later, looking through emails as a result of public records requests and congressional inquiries, that he got his contract simply by saying, hey, I have a bunch of masks, and a contract officer at the VA said, quote, guy looks legit. And that's how he got his deal. So it's not even the bidding process. You know, there are no guns in this story, but, it did have sort of a war dogs element to it, in terms of we were that desperate and that ill prepared that, you know, these poor contract officers were just saying, you know, you get a contract, whatever, let's see what comes back. And what that did was create this frenzy, this underworld of people all trying to get, you know, their piece of the action. And it drove up prices, and, you know, states and cities and hospitals and the federal government are all competing for the same supplies. It was a real nightmare.
Is that what's inherent to the dysfunction and the fraud that you write about, is the process of contracting out these functions? I mean, that's kind of a meta question about your work, but that's what sticks out to me for sure.
Yeah, we, you know, the United States is very reliant on outsourcing. It's, you know, it's how we do things, and it's a lot of people's bread and butter. So there was always going to be a little bit of a mess here. And I sort of instinctively knew that the moment we're spending this kind of money and we're throwing out the red tape and we're just trying to award contracts, people were going to take advantage. But I still was really taken aback at the breadth of the fraud and the brazenness, frankly. I mean, most fraud is perpetuated business to consumer, business to business, right? But in history, though we have a rich tradition in America of screwing each other over, you rarely see people try to take advantage of the government so brazenly, because the government keeps notes. You know, you have auditors and you have contracts, and there are consequences, and prosecutors are going to come after you. So there was something about this moment, and I think people might have been taking cues from the man who was sitting in the White House at the time. People really thought they can get away with this stuff.
Yeah, and I got to say, it also, for those people out there who laugh at the idea of, like, you know, federal government experts, LLC, it worked.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes
says it
seem
right in the title.
These experts.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Prestige Ameritech, another character in the what can you tell us about them?
So this is a company it's led by two gentlemen, one of whom was Mike Bowen, down in Richardson, Texas, near Dallas. He was the guy, you know, he's just the one who understood masks when no one else cared about these damn things. And he'd been warning the federal government for 13 years, three different administrations, every agency that was relevant, saying, if we're hit with a pandemic, we are not going to have masks. We're going to be reliant on China. They're going to choke it off, and Americans will needlessly die. And no one was listening to him. And I was just fascinated by the fact that he kind of sets off this chain of events in D.C. because he forms a relationship with the bureaucrat here. He sees in early January 2020, the sales from his website, this obscure corner of his website, are going through the roof. And he's looking at the names, and it looks like these are, you know, Chinese Americans who might be sending these things back home. There's this sort of novel virus out there. And he actually fires off some of the first warnings and says, we're in deep shit. You know, these masks are flying out the window. You need to beef up supplies. If you don't buy from me, buy from somebody else. And he gives a list of all everyone who's making these things. And he really wasn't listened to quickly enough. And, you know, it comes out later that the federal government had turned down an opportunity to have domestic mask manufacturing ramped up so that we weren't so reliant on people like Robert Stewart Jr. and federal government experts.
Why? Like, could you figure out the reasoning of that? Was it we didn't want to expend the money, or was it more like we don't want to indicate that we think this is real?
You know, it was a little bit of the latter, but it was also just personality. So the Trump administration is trying to downplay this thing, right? It's inconvenient in election year. And but there is someone in the White House, Peter Navarro, the president's trade advisor, who was really behind the trade wars, who understood the threat despite his eccentricities and so forth. He understood we need to get things moving in what he called Trump time. So he's awarding contracts to people, and he inserts himself, and this is historically significant, into the federal purchasing apparatus, and is just kind of the guy, which is problematic in a lot of ways. But he ends up talking with Mike Bone and Prestige Ameritech, and they're sort of talking past each other. I was looking through their emails. Peter Navarro wanted to know, you know, I want X amount of masks for this price. I will pay you tomorrow. I can get it done because we're not afraid to break rules. And Mike Bowen was saying, look, we almost went bankrupt during swine flu. If I hire people and ramp up production, I need to know that this makes business sense. So they were talking past each other. They're both strong personalities. And eventually Peter Navarro moves on. And the strategy is to just throw money at unknown people who are lying about their ability to supply masks, when in fact Mike Bowen had an actual factory where he could make these things. So, you know, just personalities and silliness got in the way.
I mean, that's more than, I think, like personality on some way. I mean, because I feel like that dynamic exists in this country. I mean, in every, and I haven't, admittedly, have not had that many experiences, but in every corporate setting I have been in, or any type of even like company, that idea of like the people who say yes to you the easiest are the ones you're convinced are the most competent. And the ones who actually like raise some type of challenge because they're actually doing something, get booted. I mean, this is the problem with having a guy who's in charge of this has no authority, as far as I could tell, right? Navarro was not, there was no, he just assumed this role, it feels like.
Right. Yeah, he had no right to be ordering contracts, but he did it anyway.
And he has no idea what he's talking about, so he doesn't understand the concept of, like, I can't ramp up production and hire these people. Like, I can't go to the temp agency and get, you know, 100 people to come in tomorrow to my factory and right, ramp things up and just have them work for 2 weeks and sell this. You need some type of commitment, right? I mean, this is the thing. Like, we did that with Operation Warp Speed, it feels like. We said to these companies, we're going to order $1 billion, you know, billions of dollars worth of vaccine, whether it works or not, because that's the only way we can get you to committed to doing this. But at that time, when it came to masks, we didn't have a clue about that.
Right. Yeah. Operation Warp Speed is sort of the foil to the rest of the story. I mean, our instinct to just throw money at a problem, in the case of Operation Warp Speed, we have a vaccine now, and a lot of people got rich. We can talk about whether or not, you know, that was equitable, but we did get something in return. When it came to those early countermeasures, masks, gloves, gowns, things like that, we just lacked foresight and the credulity within the Trump administration and, you know, government bureau. These are people who are used to buying chairs and paper clips and reams of paper. Now they're suddenly in charge of life-saving equipment. I can't help but have some empathy for these folks. Like, what are you going to do? Of course, I'm going to give somebody a contract and see what happens. But it, you know, it really put jet fuel on this problem.
Talk about Filiquet. This is, this is, it's grotesque. I mean, I am not a medical, equipment, provider, but I feel like I would be on top of this being a problem.
So, you know, I had just been on the private jet, so I had a sense that our government had no idea what they were doing. So we're taking a look at ProPublica, we're taking a look at these contracts, and we just write a story. It's something like, you know, $2 billion or $1 billion in the first 2 months have gone to these first-time contractors, and we just threw some people in there. We call this priming the pump. We didn't have all the answers, but we thought maybe someone did. And we throw out Filiquet. This is a company that formed, I think, in late April or early May. It 6 days later got a $10 million deal with the Federal Emergency Management Agency for COVID test kits. And these are the PCR tests, you know, that require some science and some lab work. So we were just immediately skeptical because this company had no, you know, they're new. They had no footprint in medical supplies. The owner, we traced back through records, had, you know, a history of fraud allegations. So we threw it in a story. I happened to be in Texas chasing down an unrelated scam. And the state public health official calls me, says, hey, I got these test kits from this company. They're completely unusable. They're thrown in this bag. They're brittle. They don't fit standard lab equipment. I didn't know what they were. I shared them with a colleague. A colleague tells me, well, they're soda bottle preforms that are blown up with pressure and heat to be your 2 liter soda bottles at the grocery store. So I decided to stop at the warehouse. They wouldn't let me through the front door. So I kind of staked out, you know, the warehouse door in the back, and they finally open it up, and I roll up with my cell phone and, you know, taking notes, and I can see that temp workers were using literal snow shovels to round up these soda bottles, put them into smaller bins, and workers, some wearing masks, some not, were just squirting saline and screwing them on and throwing them into a bin. There's a fan whipping air around. Like, these are completely unusable. And when I told FEMA what I'd seen, they responded that they had delivered these test kits to all 50 states and territories. So they had to tell people in those states not to use these. And these were critical moments when we really needed to catch up to testing to get a handle on the virus. And that set back, you know, our national response in ways that, you know, we may never fully understand. But that company, because the federal government accepted those junk test kits, they were paid, and they contract experts we talked to said it's hard to make a case that we should get that money back because the federal government accepted their product. So they got away with it.
How does, if FEMA is sending that to all the states, I mean, this is a primary, this, they were relying, this was their, it seemed to be their primary source for these test kits, in quotes. How do they not have, like, hey, maybe we should send, you know, Miss Johnson down there to
inspect
right. Or just quality, make sure, control. That the, you know, quality control, like, you know, I mean, it's not possible to think that they're using preformed soda bottles and just like spraying saline in them, but that's apparently right. What, I mean, how does that happen?
You know, I don't know who accepted those. My sense is that it was so chaotic. They just said, sure, whatever, and shipped them to states. And it was the state laboratories and state public health officials who were left literally holding the bag of these useless test kits.
That's crazy. All right. Well, let's talk about the Paycheck Protection Program. Mm-hmm. I mean, in these areas, I mean, it seems to have been just rife with fraud. The yep. system itself, we had no system in which to deliver any of this. It was all done through basically, like, particularly the first round in particular, was done by, like, if you have a good relationship with a bank, then mm-hmm. you're going to get the loan. If you don't, which means that you're probably more in need of it in some right. respects, you won't. But talk about that. I mean, I'm more hesitant about the fraud in this because it helped some people.
Right.
It's not like sending out fake test kits. that I don't think we ever recovered from that. I really don't, actually. I think the whole testing regime ended up being completely marred by that for months and months and months because of the failures of the testing. But talk about the Paycheck Protection Program.
You're right. I mean, this was a necessary program. People were in trouble. And the idea of the program was, well, we'll funnel billions, ultimately $800 billion to small businesses so they can stay afloat and pay their employees so that they can feed their families and pay the rent, right? But as you said, it was those who had relationships with banks who really benefited from that first wave, including some corporations that shouldn't have gotten the money and they end up giving it back. So your local salon owner and, you know, your Uber drivers, the people who really needed this, didn't have access. Meanwhile, people who understood how to lie on a couple forms were getting millions of dollars within days from lenders because as Congress created the program, it put speed above all else. There was very little vetting. And in fact, there was no incentive for banks to look hard at who they were giving loans to. And eventually, you know, we catch up to some of that. The Trump administration tried to keep the data on who got loans a secret. ProPublica and other news organizations had to sue for it. And right away, stories of rampant fraud at every level spilled out, including, there were my colleagues at ProPublica found that there was this phenomenon of like hundreds of fake farms, you know, like orange groves in Minnesota, rice fields in Florida. One company, my personal favorite, was called McDonald's, not burgers, but flowers. And they got PPP loans. And these companies don't exist. They are made up, and they got forgivable loans. So it really was just a mess. And if we find ourselves in this scenario again, hopefully Congress can, you know, put in some guardrails to make sure that money goes where it needs to go. And we're not catching up to fraud for many years as we are now.
What percentage of the loans were forgivable? I mean, it was supposed to be forgivable if you give it, if this money is paid directly, you have a slate of workers.
Yeah.
I can't remember what the limits were, because you were in a different tranche, but whatever it was, number of workers, this is how much they get paid on a monthly basis, or weekly basis. And, that amount is what is forgivable. How much of the percentage of the loans were forgivable, and how much, and to the extent that the ones weren't, were they paid back?
My screen just went away. So something like half, so $800 billion total in two waves, something like half of that was forgiven. And, you know, as you stated, you know, you have to make the case that these, you know, that money went to people's paychecks. And, you know, a big chunk of that has, you know, there's been something like 500 criminal cases of fraud and many more. And each one of those instances requires a prosecutor and a case being built. So we're going to be catching up to that for a long time.
Wow. Okay. All right. Jared Kushner. At one point, Kushner, I think it was back here. I had pulled it up here. Jared Kushner, Business Insider, reported May 6, 2020, 2 years almost to the date. Jared Kushner's shadow coronavirus task force used a spreadsheet called VIP Update to procure PPE from inexperienced Trump allies. I mean, how much was Kushner? How much of this was Navarro, and how much of this was Kushner? Or is there really a difference?
It's such a mess, it's hard to say. But there are some so Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, inserts himself into the national response and stands up this shadow task force, which is sort of working on the sideline of the official task force, which is run by the vice president at the time, Mike Pence. And these are people who don't work in government. They're well-to-do friends through his business networks or whatever. And I talked at length with the admiral, the former Navy admiral, who was pulled in to handle the supply chain. And he shows up at FEMA from the Pentagon and sees these civilians walking around, these young kids. He has no idea who they are. Starts calling them the Kushner kids. And, you know, they're funneling leads that are coming in from the White House, people like Peter Navarro. They're putting them into this spreadsheet, as you said. And they're just creating a public relations nightmare. It's you know, it's unclear how important they really were, because, you know, you ultimately needed actual people in the government to award contracts. But they were steering contracts to places like New York State, which gave a guy who claimed to have ventilators something like $90 million. And it was based on a tweet. He tweeted at the president and said, "I have ventilators." So they forwarded it. The Kushner kids forwarded it to New York State, and that guy got a contract. And now the state is having to sue to reclaim that money. So they really just came into this at the worst possible time and created all kinds of confusion and, you know, just really overshadowed what actual government employees were trying to do to shore up supplies.
How much? Well, let me ask you this before. How could this have been different? Like, where was the Defense Production Act? I don't even think, like, I feel like Biden never even used it, really, in any meaningful way. I think at one point he sort of threatened about it, but Trump certainly didn't. What would have been the alternative mechanism? Let's say we had a even just relatively competent administration that was willing to acknowledge the existence of this, because you can't wish away a virus, although we seem to have done that, despite the fact that people are still getting it. What would have been the alternative world? And also, let me also ask simultaneously, was there any type of like key TAM legislation that allowed for, you know, people to, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you as a reporter could do that from ProPublica, but other places to sort of like suss out some of this, this fraud and, you know, QI-TAM basically is just lawsuits that basically deputize people to pursue these type of things.
Yeah. I don't think there was any sort of special, QI-TAM thing to emerge from this. I could be wrong about that. I think there have been some QI-TAM suits, as a result of that. And, you know, we don't do that. We report in the public interest you know, We could maybe get rich, but I'd rather write a story.
Good side job.
Yeah, I don't think you can manage both. But yeah, this was going to be messy, right? I mean, this was a historic, monumental threat. Yet there are some simple things we could have done. We could have had enough stuff in the stockpile. We could have acknowledged the virus early on in January 2020. We could have issued a contract to Prestige Ameritech and made sure we had masks going to hospitals. The president could have invoked the Defense Production Act to compel companies like 3M and Cardinal Health and so forth to stop exporting masks and instead ramp up supply for, you know, U.S. hospitals and so forth. The president could have put a public health or emergency manager in charge of the coronavirus task force instead of the vice president. There's a lot of really simple things that would have probably happened under any other administration. And when you look at the historical record, I mean, it's unfathomable to think that either George W. Bush or President Barack Obama would have handled this as poorly as Trump did. So it's really not a partisan thing. I mean, this was just a complete lack of paying attention to the threat and, you know, taking responsibility and getting things done.
Well, it's great reporting. Javid Day McSwain, the book is Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Emma, are you going to hit the road?
I think I'm going to hit the road. I mean, we'll see what we get. The count supposedly starts at 1.
The count starts at 1.
Yeah. So, I mean,
go down there, take a little footage, and then take the gondola back.
I will. I don't know where to park it, but
I gave her the keys to the gondola.
I don't want it to, you know, remain in the harbor. It's going to get water damage. That peacock logo is going to rub off.
That's right.
Yeah.
Going down. All right. So why don't Emma's going to jump out. Folks, let me take this time for you to tell you that The Wilbur Theater show is going to be awesome. We have showed Bradley this morning. I didn't have a chance to show anybody else some of the stuff we got going on there. But I also spoke or have traded correspondence with Ted Leo about the why'd you do that? Oh, you,
Bradley, I'm bristling with excitement.
God, I've never seen that before, Bradley. That was very odd reaction. You, it's like you saw a mouse or something.
I love Ted Leo.
And he has assembled a small, I guess it was a quartet, and of Boston luminaries, rock luminaries, and they're going to be doing music. We're also going to have some activists there. Natalie Scherr is going to be there, and of course, we have a special guest.
It's going to be a very packed show.
It's going to be a packed show, and
both the lineup and the audience packed. Both packed.
Yes, but with that said, I got news for you, folks. There's still a few sweet seats left at the Wilbur. Do not sleep on this. 2 p.m. Sunday, May 15th. Get your tickets while you can. Regret is a horrible thing to have, and I can tell you right now, you will regret it if you are not there. If you're on the fence, and you're thinking, should I go or not go? Is it going to be worth it or not worth it? I feel bad for you if you don't go at this point, because of the regret that is going to permeate your life afterwards. Why didn't I go? Why do I always make such bad choices? Why?
And then, you know, you got to learn to, you know, talk to yourself a little bit nicer, I think, too.
Yes. It's okay. I screwed up. I screwed up, but I'll get it right the next time that the Majority Report comes to Boston and has this special guest and this lineup and Ted Leo plays. Well, in the next lifetime. But don't beat yourself up too bad about it. You can recover, but you will never... You can be whole again as a person, but you just won't have experienced it. So, also, just got an IM. Tommy from Yucubia says, "Wouldn't it be a guandola in the Gowanus?" That's pretty good, folks. Just a reminder: it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free half, free of commercials, and you get the fun half. And a reminder, and we're playing around with this. We haven't quite figured out what we're going to ultimately land on this, but for this week as well, the Fun Half link, if you're watching live, the Fun Half link is in the YouTube description. We're also dropping it in the chat of the existing live show right now. And then when we go to the Fun Half, click on that link, you show up at the Fun Half. That's if you're listening live or watching live. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off at justcoffee.coop. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian Media Universe? That's a great shot of you.
Oh, yeah. Well, they won't be seeing that. But this weekend on A Left Reckoning, David and I continued our Marx reading series. I think we're up to like third or fourth installment of that. But we did the thesis on Feuerbach, which ends in the hitherto philosophers have only described the world. The point is to change it. So I get David to put on his philosophy cap, and we walk through that for about 40 minutes. So if you haven't read that sort of foundational Marx text, we walk through it and in sort of like step by step. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that.
Excellent. All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the Fun Half. Oh, and when we come back, I think, hopefully shortly, we'll at least get a live feed from Emma and see if it's worth it to keep her down there. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Unpacked. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked.
Matt.
Who?
Unpacked.
What is up, everyone?
Unpacked.
Nomi Key.
You did it.
Unpacked.
Let's go, Brandon.
Unpacked.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7-8?
Yes.
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out.
I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.